Welcome to Rebel Tales. I'm your host, Dwayne Crowley. Thanks to everybody for all of the feedback that I received on the Kilmichael series over the last couple of weeks. I really do appreciate you taking the time to reach out to me and give me some stories from local family history and things that you've read over the years, and for sending me these resources over on the Instagram at Rebel Tales Podcast. Because that's part of the reason that I'm doing this, to hear those stories, and I'll hopefully be able to tie them into future podcasts. In the coming weeks, I'm going to be covering more ambushes, Cork-based to start. My Cork boys are showing as usual. But I'll start with the more famous ones, and then some of the lesser known ones, and I might tie a few of those in together. They would have been smaller engagements, but they have some great stories and characters behind them. But this week I want to cover the ambush that is often referred to as Kilmichael in reverse, which is the Clonmult ambush. And it's tragic for a number of reasons, and I'll go into them in this podcast. But I think, for me anyway, the most hard-hitting part of this ambush is looking at that famous picture from the War of Independence. And it's one that most people will know and will have seen, especially throughout the centenary celebrations. It's of 10 lads who are standing staring at the camera. And some of them have rifles over their shoulders and the other arm hanging, showing some military discipline. One of those lads has a fag hanging out of his mouth with a rifle over his shoulder. Joseph O'Hearn has his hands in his pockets and he's slouching slightly. But the thing that they all have is this steely glare, this look of toughness, resilience, defiance. But you can't help but notice how boyish that they all looked. And it brings it home that these were just young fellas that were essentially taking on the might of the British Empire in a field in Cork. For this podcast, I'll be pulling heavily from a fantastically researched book done by Tom O'Neill, The Battle of Clonmult, the IRA's Worst Defeat. I picked up a revised edition of this in Middleton Books during the week, and I think they actually sell it at the Clonmult ambush site, but I couldn't see anybody around to ask. But anyway, if you're interested in this ambush, it's a fantastic resource to pick up, this book. It's very balanced, in fairness. And as well as reading from that, I'll be looking at some of the statements that from the men who were there, from their Bureau of Military History statements. The Irish Volunteers of Clonmult were from the flying column of the 4th Battalion of the 1st Southern Cork Brigade. Now, before I kick on, I just want to take a couple of minutes to explain how the Volunteers, or the IRA, was structured at the time, because it can be a bit confusing. I'm not going to go into any great detail on it with the names and the dates, because it will distract from the names of the men of the Clonmult ambush that this episode is dedicated to, but I'll give just enough to paint the picture. And it's also very confusing because the structure has changed at different times throughout 1919 to 1921, but I'll give an overview that will hopefully make sense. So to start, one of the major lessons that was learned from the Easter Rising is that the volunteer forces couldn't expect to face the British forces in all-out conventional warfare. The British were just too well-armed, too well-trained. They had cannons, they had boats, they had garrisons, they had almost infinite resources when it comes to fueling an army, and the volunteers just didn't have that and couldn't match that. So they decided to take on the enemy in guerrilla warfare, which was small groups using local knowledge to surprise and attack the enemy and escape again, basically hit and run. Early on, the volunteers were structured into companies, which were basically very local groups based in a parish. And within those companies, there were smaller units known as sections. They were the very smallest. So these companies then batched together and were called battalions. So smaller parish companies would join together to create a battalion. Now, these battalions operated under a brigade, which covered a larger area. And early on, there was one brigade in Cork, and that was led by Tomás McCartan, the mayor of Cork, who was murdered by the RIC in his home. But it proved too difficult to manage communications. So Cork was divided into three brigades. And to make communication easier between the brigades and the general headquarters in Dublin, late in the war in 1921, the country was broken down into divisions, which oversaw the operations in their area. And there were 16 divisions covering Ireland. So to try and make sense of all that, let's just look at Cork. There was the 1st Southern Cork Division. And within that, there were three brigades. So let's take the 3rd West Cork Brigade. And that was comprised of 7 battalions from Bandon, Clonakilty, Dunmanway, Skibbereen, Bantry, Castletownbere, and Skull. The Bandon battalion was the biggest, and that comprised of 13 companies from the surrounding parish areas. So I hope that makes sense. Now, from there, where did the flying columns come from? Well, the flying columns were made up of men on the run from different areas, and they were usually picked to join if they were the most fit, the most sharp and disciplined. And they were a force that were constantly moving around, looking to engage the enemy on their own terms, where they could inflict maximum impact with minimal loss to the column. They lived on the run basically all of the time, and they relied on the hospitality of local people to be fed, to get fresh clothes, fresh socks was a big thing, getting them darned, basically just having somewhere safe to sleep for a night. And there were also military ranks within each of the levels of the structure. So different titles like commandant, lieutenant, OC, that type of thing. But dissecting the structure of the volunteers and the old IRA would be a podcast series in itself. And look, I'm sure that there are many podcasts or YouTube videos out there that can do that. But I want to keep this podcast about the people and the stories. So I hope the breakdown I just gave adds a bit of understanding. That will help you through it when I'm telling the story. So moving on to the Clonmult ambush. Clonmult is a beautiful rural area near Middleton in East Cork. I actually drove to the ambush site the other day, and you can imagine that a lot of the back roads along the way are probably close enough to the way they were back then. Not a lot of houses, beautiful green lush fields as far as the eye can see, and the roads are just about big enough for one car to pass in some places on the way up. So what happened? On Sunday, the 20th of February, 1921, the volunteers suffered the worst defeat of the War of Independence. The volunteers of the flying column of the 4th East Cork Battalion were using a farmhouse as a safe house in Clonmult. An informer betrayed their position to the British Army, who then later surrounded the safe house and ambushed the volunteers. During the shootout, 2 of the volunteers were killed outright at the opening shots. 1 escaped and 3 were killed trying to escape. The British set the thatch roof on fire, leading to 12 of the volunteers to surrender and come out of the safe house. The British then opened fire on those who surrendered, killing 7 of them. 8 of the volunteers were then taken prisoner, 4 of them were sentenced to death and 2 were executed, and the other 2 were saved by the truce. The survivors were sentenced to penal servitude, and then they were released after the treaty was signed. So that's what I'd call the history book overview. But let's dig into the reason for this podcast, which is telling the stories of those who were there. So to start, let's take a look at the British forces at the ambush. Now, there are conflicting reports as to the strength of the British Army forces that were there at Clonmult. And keep in mind, this was an army operation primarily, according to the research by Tom. But later on, we see that the British Army was reinforced by members of the auxiliaries and possibly some black and tans. So Tom writes, "The strength of the British Army at Clonmult has been estimated in previous accounts of the battle as being up to company strength, which would number approximately 120 men. It would have required 11 Crossley tenders to transport such a force. The regimental history of the Royal Hampshire Regiment gives the strength of the patrol as 4 officers and 21 other ranks, soldiers, from the regiment. 2 Crossley tenders were used to transport this force and were driven by 2 Royal Army Service Corps drivers, giving a total of 27 personnel. This number plus the informer, also taken to Clonmult, both as a guide and a hostage, corresponds with the carrying capacity of 2 Crossley tenders, which was 14 personnel per vehicle, including the driver. Local civilians that went to Rathorgan Crossroads, where the British parked their vehicles, reported later that there were indeed 2 Crossley tenders parked there. The civilians were also warned not to approach one of the tenders. The belief later was that the informer was on board. Later, when the British soldiers that were sent to Middleton for reinforcements arrived there, they found 2 truckloads of auxiliary police that were travelling between Youghal and Cork were at the RAC barracks. A number of accounts mentioned 2 truckloads of black and tans as being the reinforcements. The term black and tan was used to describe and indicate both groups of ex-British military veterans recruited during 1920 to reinforce the Royal Irish Constabulary. The first group arrived in March 1920 and was made up of men that were formerly enlisted ranks of the British forces. They were officially referred to as temporary constables of the RAC and were the original black and tans, because they initially wore a mix of British Army khaki and RAC bottle green uniforms. Within a few months, they were issued with complete RAC uniforms. Around August of 1920, the temporary cadets of the Auxiliary Division, Royal Irish Constabulary, began to arrive in Ireland, and again, because of their khaki and green uniforms, were also referred to as Black and Tans. These men were formerly commissioned officers of the British forces. Both groups had extensive service during the First World War. On this occasion, it was members of the Auxiliary Division that provided the reinforcements for the British Army at Clonmult. It was also standard procedure that all British military and police convoys would consist of at least two vehicles. Approximately 24 auxiliaries travelled to Clonmult under the command of an RAC county inspector. When reinforcements were sought, it is my conclusion that some regular RAC and temporary constables from Middleton also travelled to the battle scene, including RAC constables Henry Harris and ABD Smith. So that's who was there from a British point of view. And there are two elements to me anyway to the tragedy at the start of this. One was that the column was actually getting ready to move safe houses at 6 p.m. that day after being in situ for over 5 weeks, which military historians have said was an incredibly reckless decision by those men who are a wanted force to stay somewhere where they were easily found, especially when informers were around for so long. Which is why the two of the sentries, which are lookouts, were not where they were supposed to be to keep an eye out for the British forces, which means that the British were able to surround the house with a total element of surprise. So let's get into the ambush itself. So Dermot O'Leary gave an incredibly detailed account of the ambush and actually getting shot in the head. And he highlights all of this in his Bureau of Military History statement. So I'll take the account of the ambush mainly from him from this episode. The fight at Clonmult. Before describing the fight at Clonmult, it might be as well to give an idea of the house we occupied and of its surroundings. The house was a long low building with walls of mud and stone and a thatched roof. It had three rooms. There were two windows and a door at the front of the house, and there was no back door. The approach to the front of the house was by a boreen which gave entrance to the haggard in front of the house. On the fateful day of Sunday, 20th of February 1921, in the early afternoon, Dermot Hurley, Joss O'Hearn and Captain Paddy Whelan left their headquarters at Clonmult to survey an ambush position at Little Island, a railway station on the Cork Cove line and about 6 miles south of Clonmult. An ambush on a troop train was being planned for the following Tuesday. Before leaving, Hurley gave instructions that the column should move off that evening to a position nearer their proposed ambush at Little Island. He appointed Captain Jack O'Connell in charge of the remainder of the column at Clonmult, which consisted of 12 regular column men and 4 other volunteers named Harty, Terry, Walsh and Gard. These latter 4 had come that day to the house at Clonmult with money from a collection levied on local farmers and others by order of the brigade headquarters in Cork. The purpose of the levy was to purchase arms and maintain the column then operating in the Cork Brigade area. We had taken a midday meal and we were packing up, preparing to leave. Two of our lads named Joyce and Desmond had gone to a well a few yards from the house to fill their water bottles. I chanced to look out the front window and saw, to my amazement, soldiers crawling past the gateway near the boreen. The time was now about 3 p.m. I immediately gave the alarm and almost at once the military opened fire on us from all sides. Captain O'Connell distributed the reserve ammunition and some grenades, and we replied to the enemy fire through the windows. Our position was now extremely precarious. It was obvious we were surrounded by superior enemy forces, and our prospects of fighting a winning battle from inside the house were absolutely hopeless. Realising the state of affairs, Jack O'Connell, after about an hour's firing, decided to attempt a sortie. The door was opened and Jacko, fixing a bayonet to his carbine, led the way, followed by Michael Hallahan, Richard Hegarty, Jim O'Hearn and myself. We were met by a hail of bullets. Jacko got through to the shelter of a ditch and subsequently fought his way through to the enemy cordon. Hallahan was shot dead almost on the doorstep. Hegarty was killed as he made for cover at a fence opposite the house, and Jim O'Hearn got away into the fields about 200 yards to the south where he too was shot and killed. I got out into the haggard, but seeing the other boys fall, decided there was no hope of escape and dashed back again into the house amidst a hail of bullets. none of which fortunately hit me. Inside the house, Paddy Higgins of Agada was now in charge of the beleaguered garrison. Meanwhile, firing continued on both sides, during which one of our comrades, Joyce, who with Desmond had gone to the well for water, had crawled, badly wounded as he was, to the rear of the house and told us we were surrounded on all sides by the enemy. The poor fellow died that evening. Desmond, too, had been killed, presumably as he tried to make his way back up to us, but of course, we didn't know it at that time. The British now began to close in on us, and the next thing we realised was that the thatched roof had been set on fire by them. Paddy Higgins then decided to bore a hole through the rear wall and to try and get his men out of the doomed building by the back. We set to with bayonets, knives and forks and eventually hacked the hole big enough for a man to get through. The house was now full of fumes from the burning thatch which was beginning to fall in on us. We were getting sick from inhaling all the fumes. It was then arranged that I should be the first to make an attempt to escape. I went to get through the break in the wall and had only got my head out when I received a bullet in the head and was pulled back again by my comrades. I remember creeping into the kitchen and then remember no more of what happened in the burning house. My next recollection was being propped up against the wall and I barely remember being in a lorry, but at the time I was only half conscious for brief periods. Before continuing my personal story, I wish to record what happened after I received the head wound as told to me by survivors of that fateful day. After repeated calls to surrender and having no alternative because of the house being on fire together with the fact that the place was ringed by British military reinforced by black and tans, Paddy Higgins instructed the boys to throw their guns into the blazing house and come out with their hands up, bringing me with them. This was done, whereupon the black and tans lined up the boys and shot 7 of them in cold blood. Were it not for the intervention of the British military officer in charge, all the prisoners taken would have been murdered likewise. 7 of our lads fell to the guns of the murderous tans. The names of these boys, together with those killed in action, were Richard Hegarty from Garryvaugh, Jeremiah Ahern from Middleton, Christopher Sullivan from Middleton, Joseph Morrissey from Athlone, Michael Hallahan from Middleton, James Glavin from Cove, John Joe Joyce from Middleton, James Ahern from Cove, Michael Desmond, Middleton, Donald Dennehy, Middleton, Liam Ahern, Middleton, and David Desmond, Middleton. Michael and David Desmond were brothers. Liam Ahern was brother of our Vice Commandant, Joss Ahern, and James Ahern, his first cousin. The following were taken prisoners: Paddy O'Sullivan and Morris Moore from Cove, Paddy Higgins from Agada, volunteers Harty, Terry Walsh, and Gard and myself. Paddy Higgins was badly wounded, having been shot through the mouth by a black and tan. The remainder, excepting myself of course, were unwounded. The prisoners, wounded and otherwise, were put into a lorry and taken into Middleton, where they were paraded for identification by the RIC. This explains my recollection of being propped against the wall, to which I have already referred. From Middleton, we were brought by lorry to Cork. I must have been unconscious for a considerable time, because I next remember waking up in a bed in a hospital attached to Cork military barracks, and having my head shaved in preparation for my wound being treated. My mother and sister came from Killeagh to Cork barracks inquiring for me, as I was not amongst the bodies of my comrades found dead at Clonmult. They were informed that there was no person of my name there. I'd given a false name. Concluding I was dead, my people held a wake in my home at Killeagh, and my mother even purchased a grave where I would be interred when my body was found. At the first opportunity I wrote to her, telling her I was, in fact, alive and a prisoner. With me in the hospital ward were some other patients, one of whom I remember had been the station master at Upton, County Cork. This man had fought with the IRA in the Upton ambush on the 19th of February 1921 and had been wounded and taken prisoner. His bed was nearest the entrance door. One night, following an ambush in Cork City, in which some soldiers were killed, a few military came into the room and proceeded to beat this man unmercifully with the butts of their revolvers. He died from the effects of the beating. It was lucky for me that my bed was farthest away from the door, or I might have met with the same fate. After less than a week in bed, I was told to get up. My clothes, which were blood-stained and wet, and my shirt, which was the same, were handed to me. I dressed myself, and with 4 military police as a guard, was marched across the barrack square to the detention ring of the barracks. I was desperately weak and hardly able to walk. I asked one of the guards to allow me to lean on him or permit me to sit down for a moment on a stone in the square, but I was refused. Eventually, I was put into a cell where I removed my clothes and got into a bed with a blanket for a covering. I was only a short time there when a priest came in. I complained about the condition of my clothes. After leaving me, he must have reported this because a warder came along shortly afterwards and took my clothes away, returning them later clean and dry. The following day, I was ordered to get up and go down into the barrack yard. I was so weak, I fell down some steps and was helped by a sergeant of the Cameron Highlanders. This man was very considerate to me while I was under his charge. In the yard, I met my comrades Paddy O'Sullivan and Morris Moore, and I met them there at our hour's recreation each day until we were tried by court-martial on the 19th of March 1921 and sentenced to death. We were to be shot on the following Wednesday. I asked permission from my mother and my sister to see me, but when they came to the barracks, they were both refused admission. Here, I might mention that both of them were on the run. Their home was repeatedly raided by military and TANs, with the result that they had to get out and find accommodation elsewhere. After the court-martial sentences, counsel was briefed on our behalf and our case taken to the British House of Lords for consideration. This caused a postponement of the executions. The weeks dragged on without us hearing anything definite about the decisions in our cases, and in the meantime, I used to continue to meet Paddy O'Sullivan, Morris Moore, and Paddy Higgins at recreation. Higgins, in addition to the bullet wounds in the mouth, was suffering from acute appendicitis, which he told me would need an operation. Talking about our execution, I remember saying I would ask that I would be shot with the others when the time came. We all agreed that we should go together. The next I heard was that Paddy Higgins was put into hospital for his appendix operation. My mother and sister had now got permission to visit me, and one evening early in May 1921, when in the recreation yard with Paddy O'Sullivan and Morris Moore, I was told my people were there to see me. When I'd seen them, I returned to the recreation yard and found that O'Sullivan and Moore were missing. I asked the sentry on duty where they were and he told me they had been shifted. Later that evening, as I walked down the corridor to my cell, I noticed that a sentry was posted outside the two doors of the cells next to mine and that the doors were marked with a large cross. My door bore no such cross. The two marked cells were Paddy and Morris. I wasn't long in my cell until a priest came in to hear my confession. He told me that I was to be executed the following morning. I remember asking him what time I was to be shot, and his reply was that he didn't know. Later, a soldier came in with tea, and he said that two lads were to be executed in the morning. I inquired about myself, and the soldier said, "They are keeping you for your mate in hospital," meaning Paddy Higgins. Apparently, we were to be shot in pairs. I need scarcely to say that I didn't get much sleep that night. The following morning, the 5th of May, 1921, I heard the cell doors beside me opening and Morris and Paddy passing my door, answering the litany of the rosary. Very shortly afterwards, I heard the shots, which signalled the deaths of my comrades. In the forenoon of the same day, I met Paddy Higgins in the recreation yard. He had been operated on for appendicitis and was going in for another operation. Relating to him the events of the previous night, Paddy remarked, "They are probably keeping you from me." That evening I was called to an office upstairs in the barracks. There were three British Army officers seated at the table. One of them proceeded to read out the sentence of death passed on me and added that the sentence was commuted to one of penal servitude for life. It is not possible to state the relief I felt at this totally unexpected news. I returned to my cell where I was told to pack and get ready to leave, where to, I had no idea. The next thing happened was that I was given a bucket of water and a brush and ordered to scrub the cookhouse floor. I refused to do this and was again put back into my cell. Later on, I was marched out with a dozen other prisoners, put into a lorry with an armed guard of soldiers and taken to Cork Jail, where more prisoners were collected. One of these was Tom Crofts, OC, 1st Battalion, Cork 1 Brigade. I remember Tom coming over and shaking hands with me. We were all brought down to Spike Island, where I was imprisoned in the criminal portion of the prison. I joined in the wrecking of the cells with all the other prisoners, with the result that I was transferred to Kilkenny Jail. In Kilkenny, the prisoners who were there before I arrived had dug a tunnel under the jail to a point outside the walls. Many prisoners escaped by means of this tunnel, but unfortunately, I was in a different wing of the jail to that from which the escape was made. After a few months in Kilkenny, I was transferred to Waterford Jail, from which I was released in February 1922. Of the boys captured with me at Clonmult in February 1921, all, including Paddy Higgins, had their death sentences commuted to penal servitude for life, except, of course, Paddy O'Sullivan and Morris Moore, R.I.P. That's an incredibly moving testimony there. The account of the incredible cruelty he experienced and witnessed while a patient in the hospital is very, very powerful. It's horrific to imagine somebody lying in a bed like that and having soldiers come in a rage and beat them to death with the butt of their revolvers. It's just one of those horrible stories of this terrible war. I can't imagine what Dermot felt or thought in that moment. He must have believed that he was going to be next. In his account, he mentioned one of the most controversial aspects of this ambush at Clonmult, which is that when the volunteers surrendered, some of them were executed on the spot, which was similar to the situation that happened in reverse in Kilmichael only a few months before, where, depending on the account and depending on what you believe based on what you've read or heard, the auxiliaries at one stage, some of them may have thrown down their rifles, put up their hands to say, "We surrender," leading some of the volunteers out of cover before pulling their sidearm revolvers and shooting between two and three of the volunteers dead. At which point then, a couple of minutes later, those auxiliaries tried to surrender again by putting their hands up, and that wasn't accepted by Tom Barry, who commanded his forces to keep firing. If you're new here, I covered all of that in the last two episodes on Kilmichael. I put up a poll asking people if they believed there was a false surrender, and I think in and around 40 respondents, 68% said yes, and the rest were a mixture of no and undecided. So it's great that we can have these conversations and make up our own minds based on reading and understanding the accounts of those who were there. But I'm going to read from Paddy or Patrick Higgins' account of the surrender, in which he was shot in the mouth. And it goes, "The military repeatedly called for us to come out and surrender. I discussed it with the boys, and I said I would do as the majority wished. The majority were in favour of a surrender, as further resistance seemed useless as the house was now well on fire. Three of us were in favour of fighting it out, Liam Ahern of Middleton, myself, and the youngest member of the column, a lad by the name of Jimmy Galavin from Cove, the bravest little lad I ever met, but he was no more than 17 years of age. We shouted out that we would surrender, and we threw our guns into the burning house. We were told to come out with our hands up, so we did so. We were lined up alongside an outhouse with our hands up. The Tans came along and shot every man, with the exception of three, namely Paddy O'Sullivan, Morris Moore, both from Cove, and Sonny O'Leary, who had been wounded in the fight in the house. These three were saved from the Tans by the officer in charge of the military party. A Tan put his revolver to my mouth and fired. I felt as if I was falling through a bottomless pit. Then I thought I heard a voice saying, 'This fellow is not dead. We will finish him off.' Only for the military officer coming along, I too would be gone. I cannot have been unconscious for long because I remember Paddy O'Sullivan and Morris Moore being told to help me to a lorry. They brought me across the fields to the lorry. I was thrown into it and with O'Leary, O'Sullivan and Moore driven to the barracks at Middleton. We were taken out of the lorry there for identification by the RIC. I was the only one identified. We were then beaten up, thrown again into the lorry and driven the 15 miles into Cork Military Barracks, where I had my wound dressed for the first time. I was then taken to the military hospital. After some days in hospital, the bullet which had lodged in my jaw fell out. It was a lead bullet, not a nickel one. I was over 3 weeks in hospital when I was taken out and put into a cage, a contraption in the barrack square where prisoners with no specific charges against them were kept. I was there for a night and then handcuffed and taken under armed escort to the Cork Military Detention Barracks." That's a damning testimony of the executions carried out on the men whose surrender the British forces had just accepted. If it wasn't for that officer stepping in, it's a story that we might not have heard. Now, there are conflicting stories that when the men threw their guns into the fire when they surrendered, that it might have caused one of them to go off, which led the British to believe that they had restarted the fight. Therefore, the surrender was void and started it all again. But when you hear Paddy's account there that there was a gun put into his mouth as they were all lined up and the shot was fired, that doesn't sound like a reaction. That sounds to me like an execution. But then again, we'll never know because these stories are so old. All we can do is read and hear and make up our minds. After listening to all of those and further reading and research, there are two things that really add something to the story of Clonmult for me. And one was from John O'Connell, who was the first out of the house and managed to get through to try and get some reinforcements. And there's something very powerful here that he wrote, and it's a short excerpt, so he wrote, "Almost immediately afterwards, fire was opened on the house from practically all sides. Although I'd been but a week with the column in Clonmult, I'd been placed in charge by Dermot Hurley before he left, a little over an hour previously. I held a hurried council of war with three other members, and it was decided to make a sortie out. The reserve of ammunition was distributed, and also the grenades, and the column started to sing the soldier song." The soldier song is, of course, "Our Own Navian," the Irish national anthem, which was actually written by the great writer Brendan Behan, his uncle Patrick Kearney. But it's, when I was thinking about this, it's mad to think that as small children in Ireland, we learn in school, soldiers are we whose lives are pledged to Ireland, when we're learning our national anthem. The other thing that really stands out to me as a side note is in the aftermath of the ambush. Tom, in his book, writes of the immediate fallout and of the reaction of the mother of two of the men who were killed. And in an earlier podcast, it was the first part of Kilmichael, I mentioned the belief and signs of the afterlife and spirituality of some of the men. And there's a powerful story included here. "On Monday morning, the national newspapers gave brief details of the battle and had 13 as the number of IRA men killed. However, due to the confusion of the battle, it is understandable that this incorrect figure was given. In reality, 12 IRA men had been killed and their bodies had been left overnight beside the smouldering ruin of what had been their billet at Clonmult. The British troops returned to collect the bodies on Monday morning at around 9 o'clock and carried out a more thorough search of the immediate area. The British were convinced that the body of the column commander had been removed by the IRA during the night. This gave rise to the figure of 13 killed. The bodies were conveyed to Victoria's barracks on Monday. For the remainder of the week following the battle, the British were active around Clonmult, searching for and interrogating suspects. Information on the battle gradually reached the families of the column members on Sunday night and Monday morning. The mother of the two Desmond brothers, Michael and David, was very ill in bed at her home in 17 Commissioners Building, Middleton. This red brick terrace of houses on the Dungourney and Clonmult Road out of Middleton was later renamed Clonmult Terrace in honour of these three men from the terrace killed at Clonmult, the two Desmond brothers and Michael Halloran. At about 6 p.m. on the Sunday evening, her daughters, who were in an adjacent room, heard her speaking to someone. They went to her bedroom to find that she was alone, and they asked her to whom was she speaking. She told them that she had been speaking with David and Michael, and that everything was all right. They were with God. The family of Christopher O'Sullivan saw his bicycle in the back of an army truck when it was passing through Middleton. Dick Hegarty's younger sister heard that her brother was dead when she was called out from her school classroom on the Monday morning. The distress endured by all of these families was echoed in the community." And following on from that, there's two other very emotional sections. One is the testimony of Captain Patrick Whelan when he went to the ambush site after hearing about it to try and help his comrades, but instead he found the bodies of 12 of the men who had been killed. In Tom's book, he writes, "After the British had left the scene, some of the locals, including three young women, ventured to the battle site. These were two Miss Mulcahy's and a Miss Allen. They were accompanied by the local Catholic curate, Father Curtin, who rendered the spiritual assistance of the Catholic Church on the bodies of the dead men. Second Lieutenant O'Hearn and Volunteer Stanton, both of the Dungourney Company, were at the scene when they arrived. The 12 bodies had been collected and placed beside each other with their faces covered with canvas. This was how they were found by their comrades at about midnight when they returned. Captain Whelan best described the harrowing scene. I undertook the heartbreaking task of uncovering their faces and identifying them, calling out each consecutively. This sad task took me some time, but between sobs of anguish, I managed it. There were two distinct pauses as I went along the row, as I had great difficulty in naming Liam O'Hearn, Joss O'Hearn's brother, and Jerry O'Hearn, first cousin of Joss. I will not even attempt to describe the mental anguish of Dermot O'Hurley. All four of us, Dermot, Joss, Jacko and myself, sobbed with a terrible grief and sense of loss at the fate that had befallen our beloved comrades, some four or five of whom had bullet holes in the face just below their eyes where they had been shot by the Tans while prisoners." So that's something that we rarely hear about, the reaction of the friends of the men who, you know, the comrades of the men who died, finding their bodies and feeling absolutely helpless that they weren't there to help them. But I want to finish with an incredibly powerful letter from Pat O'Sullivan to his mother just before his execution. My dearest mother, I sincerely hope and trust that God and His Blessed Virgin Mother Mary will comfort and console you and enable yourself and poor father to bear this trial with patience and to suffer all for the holy will of God. Also, my loving brothers, relations and friends. I am in great spirits and pray for the hour to come when I will be released from this world of sorrow and suffering. We must all die someday, and I am simply going by an early train. Jesus and Mary were my friends and supports in all of the trials of my life, and now that death is coming, they were truer and better friends than ever. You can be rest assured that I will be happy in heaven, and although I have to leave you in mourning, you will be consoled to think that I am going to meet God in heaven and also my brothers and sister. Why should I fear to die when death will only unite me to God in heaven? If I could choose my own death, I would not ask to die otherwise. In fact, I am delighted to have had such a glorious opportunity of gaining eternal salvation as well as serving my country. My death will help with the others, and remember that those who die for Ireland never die. Don't let my death cause you too much unnecessary worry or grief. And when I get to heaven, I will constantly pray to God for this kind and loving parents He gave me, to help them to bear this little cross. Tell my loving brothers and friends that I will also remember them. Goodbye now, my dearest and best of mothers, until we meet again in heaven and God. Your fond and loving son, Paddy. So that's an overview of the story of Clonmult from The Men Who Were There. And I'm very grateful to Tom O'Neill for writing such an incredibly in-depth book on the Battle of Clonmult for us all to learn from. I only scratched the surface of the research included in this book, so it's a must-have for anybody interested in the Clonmult ambush. And look, I've no intention of setting up a Patreon or anything like that for this podcast, but if you're looking for a way to support it, please do consider buying one of the books mentioned in any of the podcasts to support the tiring work being done by those incredible local historians who in a lot of cases have to self-publish these books. Some books are from the people of the revolution and they're long gone, but buying their biographies will encourage the publishing houses to keep them in print, and hopefully they'll still be around for future generations to pick up. So if you enjoyed today's podcast, please consider following it and leaving a review on whatever platform you're listening to it on. And I post some resources over on Instagram. You'll find that at Rebel Tales Podcast. So that's all from me today. I'll be back next week with another ambush story. And thanks for listening to Rebel Tales.